Hello, and welcome once again to Core Ideas, the podcast where we delve into all things related to lake sediments. My name is Adam Jaziorski, and I'm joined, as always, by my good friend, Josh Steenbond.
Hey, what's up?
Not too much. And today, it's kind of a big one, and in many ways, a sad and not exactly an uplifting episode plan, because we're going to round out our arc on topical paleo and limnology with an episode dedicated to really what is the most topical topics of our time.
Oh, no. Oh, no, not COVID. It can't be COVID.
It's not COVID.
Didn't we already do that episode?
It's not COVID. I'm talking about climate change.
Okay. Well, there is nothing more topical than that.
Other than COVID.
Even in the age of COVID, that's still a dominant topic of conversation in pretty much every sphere, whether it's academic, the general media,
political.
Maybe not at the water cooler. Those aren't really a thing at the moment, but it is absolutely everywhere.
Yeah. And it's already weaved its way into a bunch of our previous episodes, whether we're talking about popular paleolimnology, no plan B in the start of the environmental movement, recently talking with Liz about algal blooms. It's, you know, it's a omnipresent issue that, you know, has a whole host of problems and issues and complications associated with it.
Yeah, exactly. I would imagine it's probably come up in almost every episode that we've talked about, even the methodological ones. We're often talking about being able to infer climate change, and it's how could it not be? It's this change to the environment that has so many different ways it can manifest, so many different compartments it can impact, all of the different changes that it can or have occurred and will continue to occur. So there's the potential to use all of the knowledge that's generated moving forward as well. It's absolutely everywhere.
So maybe for the people that have been living under a rock, the paleolimnologist audience that has been living in a complete rock for the last 30, 40, 50 years, let's do a real brief recap of what climate change is.
Okay, there we go.
All right.
Good place to start.
So really, this is very familiar territory for any of our regular listeners. But really, the source of it all comes down to the release of carbon dioxide emissions into the atmosphere. It's first recognized in 1958 in an observatory in Hawaii, and a famous graph that is now known as the Keeling curve, which shows basically an increase in the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere over time. This is coming primarily from industrial release, basically burning things. And CO2 is basically acting as a insulating, or increasing the CO2 is having an insulating effect on the earth, letting heat in but not letting heat out. And the net result of this is the planet is getting warmer. And, you know, it's gone by, I guess the process has gone by a bunch of different names over the decades. I remember when I was young doing a science fair project on the greenhouse effect years and years ago, but that's not really a term that you hear very much anymore.
No, it's really gone away a little bit.
Yeah, it's like completely dropped off. Like when we pull up a Google Engram viewer, and it definitely is like a 80s, 90s kind of term that has fallen out of favor. For global warming, and then more recently, I guess, since the turn of the millennium, like climate change. I'm not sure why that was, if there was a concerted rebranding or focusing that to highlight that it's not just the heat that is the problem, it's all the consequences of the heat, or how that actually came to be.
Yeah, I don't know.
But
we've talked about this once before, and I understand sort of the greenhouse effect switch, because that's the process is still obviously linked to what's going on, but doesn't really describe the effect and the change that's occurring.
Yeah.
And maybe the potential deleterious effect in particular. And But then climate warming is obviously a little bit too specialized to some locations.
And some places like...
Because there will be a variety.
Good, depending on where you are, potentially. Sure. Whereas climate change is a little more ambiguous and ominous. And because this is a colossal problem. Because there's a variety of positive feedback loops associated with it. So there are certain tipping points or thresholds. So the idea that, you know, as the ice around the North Pole, polar ice caps melt, the water that is exposed or the ground that is exposed is darker than the snow and the ice. So it absorbs more. And so it just kind of like getting hotter makes it get hotter even faster would be one in one. And, you know, it is the environmental issue of our times and is still very much the political issue of our times. Mm-hmm. Even
and one of those things that you can just thinking about the I saw it in someone's Twitter profile that I just clicked on today, the CO2 emissions and how carefully those are tracked. And people, it's common for them to say, oh, I think it was Greta Thunberg. It says in her bio on her Twitter page what the concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere was the year she was born. And how quickly that's changed. And we've recently passed the point where there have never been humans on the earth when the CO2 concentration was as high or was as high as it is currently in the atmosphere measured in Hawaii. So it's a rapidly changing thing as well. We haven't sorted those out. So I just quickly looked it up while Adam was talking there. And Adam was born at 333 parts per million. Josh was born at 346 parts per million. And it's currently at 414. So, you know, pretty rapid acceleration there.
Yeah. And if you scale it back to like my parents, I was talking 30%, more than a 30% increase.
Yeah. Yeah. So 300. So my dad was born in 1959. So 316 parts per million that year. Yeah. So very rapid increase sort of over the since the 1950s, really.
And yeah. And going forward, there's a whole lot of nightmare scenarios associated with runaway warming and just basically increasing water scarcity, war over water resources, famine, breakdown of the ocean conveyor in terms of thermohaline circulation and the ocean currents that we all depend upon, basically the arrival of the four horsemen of the apocalypse. It is a existential threat in many ways that at some point like will force the world's hand to deal with it or be dealt with, really. As terrifying that is to contemplate. I'm very concerned.
Yeah, and I think concern is the right, well, we'll talk about this towards the end, at the tail end of the discussion. Concern is probably the right emotion to, if that's an emotion or response. I don't know about dread necessarily, but it's certainly something that needs to be, it's good that it's so commonly talked about in the media because it is really something that needs to be dealt with. And the more pressure, the better.
And, you know, it's one of those things where the best time to have dealt with it would have been probably like 30, 40 years ago.
Like in the 70s, for example, it had already been identified, but there was good evidence carried out by companies like Exxon, oil and gas companies, to show the impact that would be felt of emissions increasing in the atmosphere, and modeling, excellent modeling that, you know, held up quite well considering it occurred 40 years ago. That would have been a really good time to start to address it. Now it's going to be a little bit more challenging.
Instead, it got filed away. And
yeah, lost. I'm sure it was an accident.
All right. So now that I'm feeling particularly emotionally fragile, why should paleolimnologists care about climate change? Maybe that's something to talk about in the next segment. So really, What can paleolimnology contribute to climate change analyses, and why should paleolimnologists, I guess, care more than Joe or Jane public about climate change, I guess, because the science as a whole is very much concerned with the past, whereas all these climate change concerns are about the future.
Yeah, it's an interesting one because it's probably both in that the paleolimnologist listening should care maybe a little bit more because there's implications for the day-to-day activities of being a paleolimnologist, whether you're studying climate change specifically or not. It's an ever-present, as we've said, part of at least the recent past, but there's also long-term climatic changes that we know have occurred over much longer timescales. And so understanding climate is important, right? But also I think the general public should probably care what paleolimnologists have to say about climate change because of those same factors, in that you do have to have maybe not an in-depth understanding of climate forcings or modeling that goes into the general circulation models that are used to predict future changes. No one's saying paleolimnologists are experts in that, but there is this contextual understanding of environmental change in the realm of atmospheric temperature and associated impacts. So that's my reason, I think.
Yeah, no, I'm on board with that reason. I'd add to that, you know, one thing paleolimnologists look at a lot is potential recovery from various impacts and like a wide variety of environmental stressors. We've talked extensively, for example, last time about acid rain. And one key thing to keep in mind in all sorts of like recovery analyses is that climate change is basically totally ensuring that a return to baseline conditions is effectively impossible on any meaningful timescale. Like the game is changing fundamentally. So yes, your pH may be going up, but a return to the ecology that was there 40, 50, 60 years ago, is likely not possible when you're dealing with significantly shorter winters, less ice cover, hotter summers. Basically, the conditions are different than what they would hope they would recover to. So, you know, what's going to establish itself as the new normal will be changed due to a warmer climate.
Yeah, there's a completely different state. Or, well, maybe not completely different, but significantly altered limnological conditions to recover into, I guess, for lack of a better word. So yeah, understanding climate and the potential effect on the ecosystem very broadly is essential for being able to put any change into the correct context and to be able to do any prediction at all, as much as that can be possible in some of those cases.
And then on top of that, even though lake sediments are not typically where you turn when you're looking for global information on past climate conditions, that's something more associated with like ice core analyses. I guess it depends. Yeah. But really, a lot of paleolimnological studies are where you're going to get more localized information or tease about regional variability.
Yeah, I would say that if you're looking for high resolution climatic studies, you probably wouldn't first go to a lake record. But now, if you want the longer term ones, the deep lake sediments, particularly in the really large old post lakes that have spanned beyond the glacial, the most recent glacial, are not bad indicators. So like Lake Baikal, because there's no ice caps near to central Eurasia that can be accessed for ice core records, or the African Rift Lakes, because there's no glaciers in Africa, are good uses of lake sediments for pure paleoclimate type of reconstructions. But at a global scale, those would be the more unique ones, at least that I'm aware of.
Yeah, and climate change is, we're going to, you know, repeatedly keep coming back to. It's quite complicated. And there's a heavy need for localized information because up until very recently, you know, areas like the Hudson Bay Lowlands were actively cooling due to just the way that I can't even put it into words properly, like global currents, air currents and stuff. But it was like an anomaly where the world is rising in temperature, but temperatures were dropping in this particular region until the last, I don't know, decade or so. And so individual lake records would allow you to tease apart that kind of variability going from region to region to region.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we always say the Arctic is warming, you know, 50% or 40 times faster than the global average. Well, that means that somewhere has to either be warming really slowly or cooling. And that's often one of the things that is brought up by, you know, people who are denying climate change or questioning the science behind it, or those kind of variable responses. But it perfectly fits with what we know about how climate changes from modeling. But in order to really track that, you do need to be able to tap into those local sources of archive data, because models have to be verified in order to do the best job that they can. And having lake records in all of these different locations, particularly in the more northern hemisphere, the less arid locations, obviously, is critical to being able to understand that variability, but also then to test those models.
And so, you know, we've heard lots about climate forecasts, but one way to test the accuracy of those climate models is to apply them backwards and perform a hindcast to see if it matches with what has been recorded in the lake sediments over time in terms of climate signals. There's also a role for vegetation studies using lake sediments as one way to track changes in the range of various species. I think so it's not really a climate change in terms of the last couple of decades, but one of the first projects in paleo I was ever associated with was like looking at the movement of a tree line in an alpine setting, and basically a lake was near the current location in the tree line, but there'd been vegetation evidence through time of basically that tree line going up and down the mountain past lake. So at various times it was below the tree line and able to track that through the sediments, and then doing that at a larger scale can be quite valuable in terms of examining the change in range of various species, which would tie into future projections of what may happen going forward as temperatures become warmer.
There's lots of examples of that from the deglaciation and subsequent range expansion of all of the vegetation communities in areas that had glacial cover, and also areas that didn't, because even if there wasn't a big glacier covering some area, there was still colder conditions, and climate envelopes have moved north in the northern hemisphere and south in the southern hemisphere to accommodate that. And you can track that with often pollen records Adam's talking about there, and some other biomarkers and things like that. But yeah, very common over a long time scale. Some of the earliest paleo records that we talked about in our early history, and when we were discussing pollen analyses of post-glacial long sediment core records, are still commonly, you know, used as ways of tracking how vegetation communities did respond and how they might respond moving forward under similar types of climatic changes. But then there's always a question of how they'll respond in terms of the rate of temperature change, which is obviously much more accelerated in the modern warming than it was out of the deglaciation. So a really important role there to understand two kind of components, the speed and also the distance kind of component.
Yeah, and because the timing of a wide variety of impacts is totally related to, in many ways, to latitude and the variable onset of a variety of stressors. And so although we associate like climate warming, like again, really second half of the 20th century, the disappearing Arctic ponds that John Small has been studying for decades now, you know, they show climate impacts dating back to the early 1800s, which is, you know, pushing the line at the time earlier than anyone thought was pushing it back earlier than was, I guess, the widely held belief at the time.
Yeah, certainly there might have been argument whether there was even a noticeable change in the atmosphere at that point, but that there were effects, that there were impacts on ecosystems was not a very popular or even widely held view at that time, not just amongst the general public, but amongst scientists. There was a great deal of, I think John may have mentioned this in the episode he was on, and if not, certainly it comes up often enough in his talks that friends and colleagues didn't believe that in 1995, when the very first science paper that they published on the ponds by Marianne Douglas, and the response to a response to climate change in those ponds, that there was quite a bit of pushback from people who are now, you know, staunch advocates of anthropogenic climate change and warming, because there's been a lot more evidence now.
Yeah, like it ties into the whole, idea that some sort of global conspiracy of scientists all colluding to perpetuate climate change hoaxes, absolutely ridiculous, because scientists are often the toughest people to convince. And so when you have a general consensus there.
He talks about this all the time. Yeah.
It's like, you know, in many ways, they're professional skeptics. And, you know,
it's really herding cats to get a bunch of scientists to do anything, unless there's like free food, or a buffet line, you're never going to get everyone to follow the same path. And yet there's such consensus on this topic.
Well, it's just, we're getting to the point when it's, you know, at one, like the ability, we're, you know, the plausible deniability is long gone. It's like, even in, you know, my lifetime, like the difference between, you know, the amount of skating on ponds you could do here during March break, you know, now versus 30 years ago. Like it's, you know, eventually at some point, you know, you get to the point where it's going to be a very tough time saying, you know, no, it's totally normal to have winters without any snow in the GTA.
For sure. Or, you know, pick an example of the things we talked about, like that 24 of the largest, of the 25 largest wildfires in the history of California have occurred in the last 3 years. Those kind of numbers, I'm sure those numbers are wrong, but the sentiment is correct that all of the evidence is so significant.
Yeah, that it's just part of the human experience now. It's like, it becomes a case of, you know, the idea of just pushing the narrative that everything's fine, nothing's changing, like it's always been like this, is just, you know, we're kind of on the cusp of this being like, that is completely implausible. Even you don't need a scientist to, you know, it's like in everyone's living memory, becoming a thing.
But one of the things that does get thrown out, and maybe the last thing that paleolimnology in particular can contribute to that, and we've talked about it a little bit already, is, you know, the thing that is most commonly probably still used in the climate denial sort of evidence, with very, very large air quotes on that word, is the idea that there is this natural variability in climate going back in time. And this is just part of an ongoing cycle. It's sunspots or it's whatever. I don't think they break out the like orbital forcings terminology all that often, but it's just part of this natural cycle. And the really nice thing about having these long archives going back is that you can put those previous changes into the correct context. So we can look at the response in the ecosystem, or just infer the change in temperature of the medieval warm period or the Holocene climate optimum, the Little Ice Age when it was colder, and how that varied across different regions of the planet, because it wasn't, you know, a consistent response for any of those time periods globally. And therefore, look at the way in which we can take natural variability out of the equation and kind of come up with the excess that is anthropogenic.
Yeah. And those long records really allow a detailed look at the rate of change to say, yes, you know, in various ways, temperature may have been higher, lower than today, but one of the big things that is very different is just the rate that things are changing in terms of its level of precedent or lack thereof in the long-term records. And climate change on its own is not necessarily, I guess, a thing that many paleomnologists study in isolation. I guess it really comes down to its role as a threat multiplier, its interactions with a variety of other stressors, and how it can change everything. And, you know, in a nutshell, it is really complicated.
Yeah, absolutely. As you would imagine, you know, there's climate is hard to teach just what's going on in, you know, even a few lectures. There are whole degrees, obviously, in climatology, and people study it for their entire lives. And trying to explain how temperature comes to be, or how that influences precipitation, or any of those linkages in climate, just climate itself, is quite complicated. And then to imprint that onto the impact it's going to have on the landscape, the watershed, the lake itself through its physical, chemical, and then all of the biological processes, is just an enormous web of connections to try and begin to understand the linkages of.
Yeah, because basically it's a product of everything on the planet interacting together. So picking a spot and saying, we're going to start here because this is the root point where everything emerges from, is just not possible.
Yeah, it's the butterfly effect kind of. Yeah.
And I guess one of the things that it's really interesting is the wrong word, but kind of really jumps out when you start looking at like a warming climate, is that always seems to help out or exacerbate the problems. You know, like we've talked about increased cyanobacterial blooms, disease-bearing mosquitoes expanding their ranges, higher number of devastating forest fires, stronger, more frequent hurricanes. It's never, you know, rainbows are becoming prettier as the temperature gets warmer, or things like that. It's just, where's the upside? Just, there is no upside.
Well, I mean, it may be relative. There may be some, but those are probably dwarfed by the more negative things. And that kind of makes sense, right? Because it's basically throwing a wrench into a system that's not stable per se, but is adapted to conditions changing quite slowly in the climate. And anytime big, rapid changes in environmental conditions broadly happen, bad stuff tends to go down in the historical record. Mass extinction events being an example of that. There are catastrophic changes when there's impact with extra terrestrial bodies. All of those kind of things tend to result in bad stuff going on, and that's just really at least a big part of that is the rate.
Yeah, because you know, there's own in terms of like vegetation ranges, for example, there's only so far individual tree specimens can move in over the course of a particular generation. And then different cycles that may have been historically in sync, but prey species responding at a different rate than predator species. And it's just the complexity of the interactions just seems to come up again and again and again. So we've talked, for example, about eutrophication and how, you know, there's lots of efforts to reduce the amount of nutrients going into fresh waters in order to control algal blooms. But then you have, okay, but now the water is warmer for a longer period of the summer. It's ice-free for a longer period of the year. So your algal blooms are potentially happening at lower nutrient concentrations than they would have several decades ago. We talked about the sensitivity of some aquatic invertebrates to reduce calcium in the water associated with acid rain. And then all of a sudden, increased temperatures and higher metabolic rates in terms of increased water temperatures potentially increases the sensitivity, so that all of a sudden your calcium threshold might move higher in some cases as the water temperature goes on.
Yeah. We talked about storm surges and how storms that would have occurred in the fall normally, it's not that the Arctic Ocean, I think from a northern perspective, isn't stormy. At times, it obviously can get really whipped up. But because there's less sea ice, because sea level has increased even very slightly in a low-lying ecosystem, those result in storms being able to impact the coastal areas much more significantly than they might have if there was this cover of ice on top of the ocean to keep the storms from getting kind of out of hand, as it were. There's lots of synergisms, link these together. I don't think we've really talked too much about oxygen concentrations specifically, maybe from a method perspective, but not from a environmental impact perspective, but the potential for warming conditions to alter and increase the potential for deep water oxygen depletion, so anoxia or hypoxia, has huge implications for fish communities.
Yeah. So for anyone that's not familiar with that, basically in diamictic lakes, where you have a temperature separation in the summer with like the warmer water not mixing with the deeper, colder water, basically, that is a barrier, presents a barrier between the bottom waters and the air, so they're not getting fresh oxygen. So whatever was in there when you had your initial spring turnover has to last through the whole summer. As the summer gets longer, you run into situations where the oxygen condition is depleted before the fall turnover occurs. And again, that ties into various habitat ranges, but then all of a sudden you're running into situations where cold water fish that spend their summers down in the bottom cold waters basically are forced more often into the warmer waters where they do not like to be in order to feed, simply because there's no oxygen down there. So that's just another, like, you know, the knock-on effect of warmer temperatures impacting ranges, because it's actually impacting physical changes within the habitat.
Yeah, we could go on and on with this list for quite a long time. We talked about permafrost thaw and all of these kind of geomorphic disturbances. They're natural in the ecosystem, in the environment. They happen, but they're bigger, they're faster, they're resulting in slightly different impacts to the actual receiving bodies and ecosystems that they're impacting. And so that is something that, you know, maybe one of these would occur every 30 or 40 years.
I think you're a little bit.
And now they're occurring.
You're super familiar with like a, you know, a slump. But I remember even, you know, talking to you about your project. Like, I mean, I've spent no time up north. I was blown away by the scale of like watersheds falling into the lake that I think most people, I think we'll have to put some photos up and just get a sense.
Yeah, for sure. It's true. You do kind of take for granted that you've seen these things. So a slump just generally is, it's like a kind of landslide, to use a colloquial term. It's where the surface material detaches and rides along something that's below it. And slumps are sort of a rotational type of slide. So they look like these C-shaped or curved convex scars that form on the side of lakes and rivers and the ocean They're really common in the Arctic Ocean, and you see them often. If you see a picture of permafrost on the Arctic, it's from the Tuktoyaktuk coastlands where these slumps occur, and they can be massive. I've been on a helicopter that's landed inside of them and had plenty of space. The pieces of material that are falling from the slide, the landslide, can be the size of school buses moving down the slurry into the bottom of them. And they're among the most catastrophic and conspicuous forms of permafrost thaw. And they are occurring faster and they're bigger. And they're occurring in areas where they didn't very recently. And we know something about why that's occurring after quite a few years of research. And it's definitely a linkage to the rapid climate change.
Yeah. No, it's definitely a very conspicuous visual image. Like, it's pretty hard to visualize what, you know, increased hypoxia in the bottom of a lake, you know, looks like. It's like a more, at least to us, theoretical kind of issue. But a massive thaw slump is a little bit more, oh, you know.
Yeah, it's kind of the thing that you see on magazines and that kind of visual manifestation of climate change.
Look, it's up there with like the melting glaciers with the sticks of like the recession of like, you know, this is where it was in 1992, this is where it was in 1993, and so on.
And now it's gone, and those kind of things like the Athabasca Glacier and in the Columbia Field in Canada, but there are examples all over.
And that's only talking about environmental ills. There's a whole suite of social ills associated with these changes. And basically in the same vein as it exacerbating the problems, it's like takes the most serious humanitarian issues in the world and amplifies them, whether that's hunger, poverty, lack of access to clean water, and, you know, coming climate refugee crises. Like, I'm totally depressing myself here. I don't know if I want to put anything else on this list of crappy things.
Yeah, there probably are some.
Oh, there are lots. There are lots.
But you can't hide from them. They certainly are there. And the more people come to realize that, then the more potential there is to start to make some changes that can actually benefit.
So is it possible to end the show on a more hopeful note, or are we just having our, you know, are we the baddies moment?
I don't know. I don't know. I think there's maybe a little too much emphasis put on either being hopeful or being completely broken by the state of things. I think a really healthy dose of realism is the best way to understand all of these things, because some of those things are really bleak, and they will be bleak, and that's the nature of it. But also,
I was gonna say, what point does realism become nihilism?
Well, yeah, I guess so. Because you can be hopeful and you can consider all of the little things that you can do individually to improve your ecological footprint, for lack of a better word, and do all of those things. But that only will take us so far. And being completely broken and doing nothing is not going to solve the problem either. I think you just, the key is to put forward some potential solutions and a way of moving forward.
Yeah, I think, you know, as depressing as it all is, you know, there's no point being ashamed of the world that you were born into. You know, we did not directly, you know, the problem was all like, I will eventually have this conversation with my kids. It's like the world was already on this path on the day you were born. And it's not your fault. You know, you can help out on some level and be mindful of what needs to be done.
Absolutely. And then the other thing is that, you know, we've been born into the most privileged location and time that you could ever be a human being a couple of white men in, you know, Canada and born at this time period. And the other thing that I think is probably, you know, we look at it from this perspective, and the kind of sadness or just being completely broken by climate change is something that is, I'm pretty sure, very or very much localized to that kind of perspective, because there's the potential for the loss of things that, you know, we're familiar with and we've known. If you go to other parts of the world, that's just the reality of the world that is existing now and will exist into the future. And in those locations, then, you know, realistic, actionable things to do at a global scale are the key and what need to be pushed.
Yeah. And, you know, I guess there's some, I guess part of the reason we are where we are is it's not really a problem that can be solved at the grassroots level.
No.
You know, we are now, and we live in a world where I think just recently in the last week, 2 weeks, something like that, it was some, I remember seeing some stories about how now, you know, the top 1% of Canada is in full control of 30% of all the wealth in Canada. Sure. And, you know, it's like, there needs to be top-down movements, because there's only so much that on an individual level that all of us switching to canvas bags over plastic bags and composting our tea bags and this, that, and the other is going to impact the world. It needs to be, you know, an electrification of the transportation network and things like that.
And everything like that. You know, there has to be so many, it has to be done at every level, but by not entirely, but led at a very high level. It's a few years out of date, but the fact that 100 companies produce more than 70% of the global carbon dioxide emissions, and every single one of them, or maybe save one of them, is an oil, gas, or coal corporation, is, you know, that's the entire problem right there in some ways. And over at least the recent past, if we could deal with that alone, would be a really good start. And no individual is going to do that. These are the largest corporations on the planet. Some of them are state corporations, which is another problem. And so I read a good blog the other day that someone who was an environmental scientist broadly and a climate communicator, people tend to confess their sins to her, I believe. They would say, come up and say, oh, you know, I'm not very good at recycling or doing any of those things. And her answer was, I don't actually care. And she said it with a few more expletives in her blog, but I don't actually care if you recycle. What you need to do is pressure government to make meaningful goals and make it expensive and difficult to pollute and put money and energy into the solutions that we know right now will fix the problem. So yeah, that's, I think, the key. And, you know, even people who are held up, this would be my last comment before I stop going on.
Rant
about
away,
this, but
rant away.
Very recently, just in the last couple of days, and it's the 29th of April today, it'll be a little later than that, but Bill Gates was, I don't know if it was a talk he gave or a tweet he sent or whatever it was, but the idea that, you know, we won't be able to implement technologies to solve the climate crisis that we have now. We need to basically come up with new technologies in order to be able to solve this problem, because currently, you know, the technologies are more expensive than oil, gas, and it's a monetary thing. And that's true. But that's because we subsidize oil and gas in large part so much compared to some of these other technologies. And a lot of the response to that by people who are, you know, excellent climate scientists and communicators is like, you need to get out of the way, because those kind of ideas by the richest people on the planet are the ones that are holding us back from actually fixing the problems, because we give so much money at a government level to these corporations that are polluting the atmosphere. And yes, obviously there's an economic component and it's not an easy transition, but if we can figure out a way to take that and move it to things that are improving, or at least not harming the planet around us, we will be able to make some very significant goal or significant improvements in our outlook. And it's not like we'll never, you know, there'll be no warming, but to slow that to one that is not going to be those catastrophic kind of changes, we just need the political will for that to happen.
And I wonder, you know, as we continue talking about this relatively bleak topic, although bleak's not the right word, because bleak's usually associated with cold. So this unbleak topic, you know, I wonder how close we are to a tipping point. Like, I don't know how, I don't know if our next vehicle will be an electric vehicle, but it feels like
mine will, for sure. We're
it's on the cusp of that. And then, you know, I always remember John showing like two pictures of New York City, and I think it's like 1901 and 1903. And in the 1901 picture, there are, you know, I don't know what street it's on, but there's something like, you know, if you start counting them, there's like 70 horse and carriages. And if you look closely, you might see two cars. And then 2 years later, it's the reverse. Like,
yeah,
this is the whole, you know, threshold and tipping points. And then all of a sudden, when the car was readily available, and boom, everyone had a car because, you know, it was just the way, it was just this, the economic choice at the time. And,
yeah,
you know,
well, I hope so.
Once the electrified pickup trucks show up, like, I mean, that's going to be a big deal.
They already exist. You know, they're just not made by the big three automakers in North America. But that's going to change. You know, General Motors has said that, you know, in the next 5 years or whatever, they'll have 25 different models that are fully electrified. And not to give them a pass, you know, they have fought climate regulations for years and have taken so much money and fought the science of climate change as well. But now whatever is different, is it from a public's perspective that people want electric vehicles? Is it from a perspective of the government putting incentives to have people purchasing? I don't know exactly. It's probably a combination of them, but there is a state change.
Yeah. Because you're definitely seeing on some level, like the renewable energy sources, like they're reaching, you often see stories of like how close to parity they're getting, even with all the subsidies involved. I'm just, you know, so now in terms of a electric vehicle, I guess it's like more money up front, but over the long haul, you will definitely save money.
Sure. And not to say that's perfect. There's battery concerns and where we get these rare earth metals and all those sorts of things. But that's just one example at a generation, like a power generation perspective. Solar and wind technology is becoming so inexpensive, less so than new large capital projects in sort of microgrid perspectives. California today or yesterday generated 95% of their electricity from renewable sources for the first time ever for a short duration. But like that's huge. California is the equivalent of or has a higher economic output than more than half the countries on the planet. The potential is there. And I agree. I think we are at that point. I saw a bit of President Biden's speech from after his 100 days, which was yesterday. And it's hard not to be a little bit more hopeful than I might have been 5, 10 even years ago, because of the push towards these kind of changes that are occurring, not just from one person in a very important seat to make those changes, but much more broadly than that.
Yeah. Like, I mean, if you think back to, when was it? Al Gore's movie came out. Is that 2005?
Yeah, something like that.
So yeah, so 15 years ago, there still was the pivotal question was, you know, trying to convince the public this is a problem. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was about pushing science. Yeah, that was pushing the science.
We're past that step now, and we're now in the potential solutions realm, I guess. And some of them still seem far away, but it's more of a case of, you know, there's a sea change between those two points of like trying to convince the public that there is a problem versus trying to convince the public of what is the best solution to the problem, I guess, is more in the realm of where we are now.
Yeah. Yeah. So for that, based on all of that, I am a little bit hopeful. It will not be an easy road. But it seems like there is a push towards it.
All right. So I guess on that less unbleak note.
Less unbleak. Yep, makes sense.
That's probably a good place to stop. And
not only that, I think that's end this arc, is it not? I think we were gonna finish topical paleolimnology with the most topical of topics.
And
move on to something else.
Yeah, so we need to start thinking hard about what that next arc will be. And
yeah, we do
get back to basics a little bit.
Yeah, why not? It sounds like
jump back into fundamentals on some level and go from the very 40,000 foot view to the microscopic one again, perhaps.
That's right, 40 microns.
All right. So once again, thanks for listening to Core Ideas, the podcast dedicated to all things paleolimnology. If you'd like to reach out to us with a question or a comment or a suggestion for our next arc, please send us an email to coreideaspodcast@gmail.com.
Or you can contact us through Twitter @coreideaspaleo. Only one A in paleo.
All our past episodes and the corresponding show notes /blog posts can be found at our website, coreideas.ajesiorski.ca, but just find the link on our Twitter page. And I think I'm only like 2 months behind schedule on there.
And if you're so inclined, you can give us a rating or you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, SoundCloud, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Those 5-star ratings would be great, but to be honest, we don't care all that much. We're really just doing this for fun.
And that's it for now. But join us again next time as we continue to explore paleolimnology in the knowledge economy era, sticking to our ethos of pure knowledge without the economy.
# knowledge economy.